From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, two Ukrainian military planes are reportedly downed near the Flight 17 crash site as the Netherlands mourns the return of the bodies of the victims of the disaster.
The formal identification process is beginning on those first bodies. That will take days, weeks, if not months, of some of the remains, of course extending the grief for those families.
Also today we find out why the UK is being accused of hypocrisy over Russian arms sales, and the UN human rights chief who strongly suggests Israel may have committed war crimes in Gaza.
There seems to be a strong possibility that international humanitarian law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a brief summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. A national day of mourning has taken place in the Netherlands as the bodies of 40 passengers aboard Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 returned to the country 6 days after the plane departed Schiphol Airport. Thousands of people lined the streets as the hearses made their slow way to a military barracks in the Dutch town of Hilversum. Citizens paying their respects to the dead, forensic experts waiting for an opportunity to begin work that was substantially delayed until pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine agreed to release the bodies. FSN's Dan Whitehead spent the day at Schiphol Airport watching the dead arrive.
The first bodies of the victims of MH17 are being taken via a convoy of hearses being led by police to the medical military facilities in Hilversum. It is there where the formal identification process will begin. Meanwhile, at Schiphol Airport, at the moment that that plane containing the remains landed in Eindhoven, airport check-in staff leaving all of their terminals here at one of the world's busiest airports. They joined thousands of foreign travellers to look at the flowers and stay silent for a minute.
The black box flight recorders from Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 have arrived in Britain and will be analysed by experts at the government's Air Accidents Investigation Branch in Farnborough. Aviation expert Stuart John says they may not yield much useful information.
I don't think the black boxes are going to contribute very much because up to the point of the explosion, everything would have been going as normal, and that's what would be on the black boxes.
Another air disaster killed more than 40 people in Taiwan on Wednesday. A TransAsia jet crashed near Megong Airport on Penghu Island as it attempted an emergency landing. The other major story, the conflict in Gaza.
We have, in the last 24 hours, made some progress in moving towards that goal.
Secretary of State John Kerry expressing very cautious optimism after a meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Kerry then went on to a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The two men seemed stony-faced at a photo opportunity in Tel Aviv. Mr. Kerry flew into Ben Gurion Airport there despite an official US ban on flights heading into Tel Aviv after a rocket landed near the airport on Tuesday. Now the FAA in Washington has extended the ban for another 24 hours, as FSN's Daniel Wrenches reports.
The decision to continue for another 24-hour period follows a plea by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for US Secretary of State John Kerry to intervene with the FAA. Two of the three main US carriers, US Airways and American Airlines, say they're now prepared to resume services on Thursday if the FAA ban is lifted.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. More on Gaza, and the United Nations has raised more concerns of indiscriminate rocket firing from Gaza by Hamas, but it's warning that Israel's use of force could amount to war crimes. Around 650 Palestinians and 31 Israelis have died over the past 2 weeks. The UN Human Rights Commissioner is Navi Pillay.
There seems to be a strong possibility that international humanitarian law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. Every one of these incidents must be properly and independently investigated.
A South African man convicted of rhino poaching has been handed a 77-year prison sentence. FSN's South Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso reports.
The 77-year sentence is widely regarded as one of the most significant messages sent to poachers in South Africa who are killing endangered wildlife in ever-increasing numbers. Mandla Chauke's conviction included prison time for murder, illegal hunting of rhinos, rhino horn theft, illegal possession of firearms and trespassing in a national park. He was one of three poachers who exchanged fire with game rangers in the Kruger National Park after they'd killed three rhino. Prosecutors argued successfully that Chauke was liable for the death of one of his accomplices.
The Commonwealth Games is getting underway in the Scottish city of Glasgow. A television audience estimated to be 1 billion strong tuned in to the opening ceremonies. 4,500 athletes from 71 Commonwealth nations are taking part in the 11-day Games in 17 different sports. David Grevenberg is the Games' chief executive officer.
Welcome to Glasgow. We have arrived. Glasgow has set a global stage. Our world-class venues are ready. Elite athletes from across the Commonwealth are here, primed and raring to go.
And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The first bodies of the victims of flight MH17 have arrived in the Netherlands. A ceremony was held at an airbase before police escorted some 40 hearses to a military site for the formal identification process to begin. Nearly 300 people were killed when the Malaysian jet was hit by a missile attack last week in eastern Ukraine. The majority of the victims were Dutch nationals. This report from our correspondents in the Netherlands, Dan Whitehead and Sandra Gatman.
As the first bodies of the victims of MH17 touched down on board a military plane at Eindhoven Airport, dozens of hearses lined on the tarmac at the airport to collect the remains and take them to the medical military facility in Hilversum, a couple of hours away. Hilversum, of course, no stranger to this tragedy. Three entire families who lived there were killed on board. At this facility, the formal identification process is beginning on those first bodies. That will take days, weeks, if not months, of some of the remains, of course extending the grief for those families. Here at Schiphol Airport, a minute's silence was held at the exact moment that the plane touched down with the remains on board. All of the check-in staff left their desks. Passengers stood in silence. Many of them went outside Departure Hall 3. Thousands of people there viewing the flowers in silence. This, of course, the departure hall and the terminal where MH17 left nearly 1 week ago. Meanwhile, in the centre of Amsterdam, in the central square, a silent walk has been held. Our reporter Sandra Gatman has been there.
That's right, Dan. Thousands of people in the centre of Amsterdam are gathered, many of them wearing white and holding white balloons, all kinds of candles and signs expressing their anguish and their solidarity with the relatives of the victims of MH17. This was something organised by a member of the public within 24 hours. The information spread rapidly through social media, and thousands are around me walking silently to commemorate 1 week from the tragedy. There was a minute silence held in the entire country today, but for some who I spoke to gathered before this walk, that minute was simply not enough, and there's lots of confusion, lots of shock still, and they all wanted to get together and send a message to the world and really commemorate for themselves an incident which many find very difficult to come to terms with. Many of the people they know were on holiday aboard that flight, and this has come as a real shock. And before funerals and burials are held, I think the country is finding that these are the kinds of events that they can attend and really stand in solidarity with each other.
Sandra Gatman and Dan Whitehead reporting from the Netherlands. Now, as the Dutch people came out in their thousands to pay their respects to the victims, there was a stark reminder of the civil war still raging in East Ukraine. Government officials say two fighter jets were brought down just miles from the Flight 17 crash site. Our reporter in Kiev is Ira Spitzer.
The Ukrainian government has made what they call a preliminary claim that the missiles which downed those two fighter jets earlier today were fired out of Russian territory. They stressed that that was a preliminary claim. Now, we didn't hear any evidence supporting that claim other than the fact that they did not know that the rebels were in possession of those missiles. Of course, they also claim that the rebels used similar missiles or the same missile system to shoot down the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 last week. Either way, whether by saying that the missiles were actually fired from Russia or whether the Russians provided the rebels with the technology that would allow them to shoot those planes down, the Ukrainian military obviously holds Russia responsible for those actions. The rebels did claim responsibility for downing those two planes. They said they were able to shoot them down with shoulder-fired missiles. The area where those planes were shot down, the area where the planes actually landed, was only about 20 kilometers from the crash site, and that's the first incident of shooting down a plane since that crash. The Ukrainian government says they've retaken two cities in the Luhansk region as they continue an aggressive push from the north and the west to try to dislodge the rebels from those territories.
And Ira, what's the latest that you can tell us about the crash site investigation?
A Dutch-led team of 24 investigators from a group of nations is still waiting for access to the crash site to begin their investigation. Apparently, the crash site is not safe enough to access yet for those investigators. The rebels did allow three Malaysian investigators onto the site today. They were accompanied by rebels as well as 12 monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The Dutch Safety Board, which is heading up the investigation, said that its team's primary objective is to determine definitively the cause of the crash. So they're not trying to establish culpability in the crash, but simply trying to figure out what happened. Of course, they haven't really been able to start that work yet, and there have been widespread claims of evidence tampering. But when, assuming they are able to gain access to the site soon, that is what their mission and mandate will be. Several countries, including the Netherlands and the U.S., have said they also want to send law enforcement officials to the site for a criminal probe, because that's something separate from what the investigators would do.
And Ira, what else have we been hearing from the Ukrainian government with regards to the downing of this passenger plane, certainly following the release of the U.S. intelligence yesterday?
The Ukrainian government line has been consistent throughout this whole time that both the Russian-backed separatists as well as Russia bear responsibility for everything, for shooting the planes down, for denying investigators access. Of course, the Ukrainian military is at war with those Russian-backed separatists, with the attention of the world still very much focused on Ukraine and on the situation around the crash site. The Ukrainian government is definitely being very vocal about what they think and about what they think happens, because they know that they have the chance now to really influence the court of public opinion. So I'm sure we'll hear lots more information from the Ukrainian government, including more clarity, perhaps, on what happened with those two downed fighter planes.
Ira Spitzer in the Ukrainian capital. Now, UK government sources say they've found intelligence indicating that rebels deliberately tampered with evidence from flight MH17. This as the black boxes from the downed jet arrived in the UK. The Dutch government requested that Britain's Air Accidents Investigations Unit analyse the flight recorders for details of how the passenger plane was brought down last Thursday. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
The Dutch Safety Board has delivered the flight recorders to the UK. These black boxes could hold the key to what happened to flight MH17, which crashed after flying above a conflict zone in eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 people on board. Aviation expert Chris Yates explains why the UK has been chosen for this task.
We have a system in place at Farnborough, the Air Accident Investigation Branch in Hampshire, which allows us to retrieve the information on the black boxes in a safe and secure way. There are only two such facilities in Europe.
Chris Yates says the data carried in these boxes is crucial to the investigation.
We hope that they give accurate timestamps as to the sequence of events prior to the aircraft hitting the ground. So from the voice recorder, we're hoping that it may give us a recording of the explosion taking place. That will be the first timestamp. And then from the data recorders, information from the instruments on board the aircraft, which would start to issue fair warnings, and that would give us a second, a third, and a fourth timestamp. That's absolutely crucial in the investigation going forward, because we need to know that given we have intelligence the missile was launched, we have to correlate that with the time that the aircraft went down.
Western leaders say there's increasing evidence that pro-Russian separatists in the region accidentally shot down the aircraft, and they've accused Moscow of arming rebels in the area. Britain's Department of Transport has said that it would take 24 hours to download the data from each of the black boxes, and once that's done, that information will be sent to international investigators for analysis. Natalie Powell, London.
A report from a committee of British lawmakers claims Britain is exporting millions of dollars worth of arms to Russia. This comes as Prime Minister David Cameron is leading calls for Europe to impose tough sanctions on Moscow amid anger over the shooting down of Flight 17. Mike Gates, opposition Labour Party Member of Parliament and Member of Foreign Affairs Select Committee, today accused the British government of hypocrisy in urging the French to cancel arms sales to Russia. He was speaking with LBC's Andrew Pearce.
Well, the report that the Committee on Arms Export Controls has published today is an annual report on UK government arms sales. We get information from the government, quarterly information, and the latest information we have is that over the last year, the amount of export licences which have been approved for Russia, either single ones or open ones, has gone up to 285. And there are £131 million in value for the single export licences. No values given for the open ones. Could be much greater. And that clearly does mean that if you're saying to the French you shouldn't sell things to the Russians, you've got to put your own house in order. And clearly this is very embarrassing, and the charge that's coming from France of hypocrisy is probably right, unless we can get an agreement amongst all the European countries that we have a common position on this.
Isn't that the problem? Because this is, to my view, Mr. Gates, the EU at its worst, because they simply can't agree on a common approach. And, of course, we know the German Chancellor, she doesn't want sanctions because they do a lot of business with Russia and they depend on Russia for their energy.
Well, I don't think it's the EU at its worst. I think it's individual member states of the EU, because we've all got different interests. I mean, the British exports to Russia are around about $15 billion, and similar exports from France. But we are much more involved with the financial sector. The French are more in defence and aerospace. The Germans export a lot of cars. And the Italians are very dependent upon gas that's coming from Russia. So each country has got its own national interests. That's why it's so difficult to get an agreement.
What do you think the response will be now to the revelation? You've identified £130 million of arms sales, Mr. Gates, but clearly the figure could be much higher.
I think what we should do, after the Arab Spring, the British government revoked a very large number of licences for countries in North Africa and the Middle East. And I think we should look very, very closely at all the export licences, not just to Russia, but to all countries where there are dangers of internal repression. One of the countries on there are 28 countries listed as countries of human rights concern. And I think that we need to be much tighter, as the committee says, in our rules and how we apply these things.
Just finally, presumably some of these contracts are legally binding. It might cost money to get out of them.
If it's a licence, you can revoke the licences, and we have done it with regard to Arab countries in the last two or three years. So I think that the issue here is not that that there is a necessarily a long-term contract where money has changed hands. This permits the British exporter to continue to export.
Mike Gates, opposition Labour Party Member of Parliament and Member of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, talking to LBC's Andrew Pearce. This is FSN Reports. Hamas leader Khalid Mashal says he will not close the door on a humanitarian truce to halt the fighting in Gaza. Machal did say that no full agreement on the ceasefire would happen until the terms were negotiated. The development comes as Secretary of State John Kerry is in Israel to broker a truce. As the Palestinian death toll in Gaza rises to well over 600, with many civilians accounting for the bulk of those fatalities, the United Nations human rights chief suggested that Israel may have committed war crimes. Navi Pillay was speaking at an emergency debate in Geneva over the humanitarian toll during the conflict, now in its third week. Liling Tan reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The United Nations estimates that more than 650 people have died in the two-week conflict, and with Palestinians, mostly civilians, accounting for more than 600 deaths, the UN's top human rights official, Navi Pillay, expressed concerns over human rights violations.
There seems to be a strong possibility that international humanitarian law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. Every one of these incidents must be properly and independently investigated.
Pillay also condemned Hamas's indiscriminate firing of rockets and mortars into Israel, but said these actions did not absolve Israel of its need to respect international law. Citing Israeli airstrikes and shelling of houses and hospitals, she said both sides deserve better than a life of chronic insecurity and recurring escalation in hostilities.
I unequivocally reiterate to all actors in this conflict that civilians must not be targeted. It is imperative that Israel, Hamas, and all Palestinian armed groups strictly abide by applicable norms of international humanitarian law and international human rights law. This entails applying the principles of distinction between civilians and combatants and between civilian objects and military objectives, proportionality, and precautions in attack. Respect for the right to life of civilians, including children, should be a foremost consideration.
Pillay urged the international community and the UN Security Council to do more to end the ongoing conflict.
All these dead and maimed civilians should weigh heavily on all our consciences. I know that they weigh heavily on mine. All our efforts to protect them have been abject failures. More powerful entities such as the Security Council and individual states with serious leverage over the parties to this dreadful and interminable conflict must do far more than they have done so far to bring this conflict to an end once and for all.
Jordan, which represents Arab states on the Security Council, is circulating a draft resolution among members calling for an immediate, durable and fully respected ceasefire. The draft resolution is the strongest proposal to come from the Council since the conflict began. It also calls for renewed and urgent efforts by the international community and parties on the ground to achieve peace based on the two-state solution. Liling Tan, New York.
This is FSN Reports. Now, a South African man prosecuted and convicted for rhino poaching has been handed a 77-year prison sentence. Rhino horn is sought after as an aphrodisiac and a status symbol in many Asian countries, despite scientific proof that it has no medicinal properties. Our Africa correspondent is Gary Alfonso, and I began by asking about the underlying issue in the fight against poaching that the court is trying to get across.
Well, this sentencing of Mandla Chauke, the South African who was arrested in the Kruger National Park in 2011, shows that the South African courts are perhaps starting to realize the negative impact that poaching is not only having on wildlife in South Africa, but also impacting heavily on the economy of the country through tourism, which is South Africa's biggest economic earner outside of gold and some of the other mining activities in South Africa. So hoping that this kind of sentence will be a major deterrent. And it's not only this court case. Previously, of course, two Mozambicans sentenced to 16 years in prison for killing a rhino and taking the horn through the Kruger Park last year, where many poachers are from. That's neighboring Mozambique and also some of the northern parts of KwaZulu-Natal, which borders with Swaziland. And then in 2012, of a South African court sentenced a national from Thailand to 40 years in prison for selling rhino horns. So it's a serious problem, and the killing of rhinos and lately also elephant for tusks. For their tusks has become a major problem, not only in South Africa, but further up north into Eastern Africa.
How serious is the fight against the poaching of rhinos in South Africa, Gary? And can one seriously argue that these animals could become extinct due to poaching in this modern day and age?
Well, South Africa has 70% of the world's rhinos, and it's lost more than 1,000 of the animals in 2013. And this year, in 2014 already, that figure stands at way above 700. So it's a battle that the authorities are acknowledging is very, very hard to claw back. And poachers such as Chauke, who is now sentenced to 77 years in prison, not only for poaching, but also for the murder of one of the accomplices, who the prosecutors were very effective in arguing that the accomplice was shot dead because of Chauke, who was the poacher's influence. So that prison sentence sending a very, very serious signal again to illegal hunters. But coming back to the numbers, the South African authorities are desperately trying to engage the business community and also the international community to try and battle the poachers, who are having a very, very significant impact on the numbers of rhinos and reduction of numbers, and even trying extreme measures such as relocating all the rhino away from the border areas with Mozambique. And it looks like this is finally reaching the justice system in South Africa, saying that they've had enough, and there's going to be a very serious message sent to poachers who are not only endangering these very, very special animals in the southern tip of Africa, but getting them close to extinction in this case.
And apart from 24/7 patrols and heavy prison sentences, what else are the wildlife stakeholders in South Africa and East Africa doing to protect wild animals against poachers?
Well, it's well known that South Africa's nature conservation authorities are battling these poachers now on a 24/7 basis, with electric fences up between South Africa and the very porous Mozambican border, where across the border, small groups of people that live in villages are very much targeted by international syndicates who, for very, very low amounts of money, get people to go and poach these animals across the border into South Africa, cut off the horns, and then obviously very, very brutally kill these animals, and very often leave small rhinos to their own devices, and they cannot be found in time by the nature conservation authorities and rehabilitated. So it's a very serious problem. And in that instance, the Kruger National Park, which is one of the most well-known parks in the world, along with the Serengeti and the Tsavo parks in East Africa, the Kruger National Park is now considering relocating the rhinos to smaller reserves in the interior, in the bordering Limpopo province in South Africa, and also to game reserves in the Southern Cape, where there's perhaps a better grip on some of the security around some of the smaller reserves. But that will effectively mean that in some cases, the big five might not be seen in the Kruger Park, which is one of the major tourism attractions of South Africa.
Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can always get in touch with us via email, reports@featurestory.com, and follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone, with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.